You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2021 Giro d'Italia, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today, we are in Cattolica.
Cozze ci tene cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze ci tene cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Il nostro giro avanti senza Michel, abbiamo Peio e Caruso che sono due ottimi corridori e da domani cambierà, ma non del tutto il nostro giro, perché comunque siamo venuti qua per fare bene e continueremo così sulla nostra strada.
Well, Daniele Fribarancini, Frappuccino, who did we hear from there at the start?
We heard from il Delfino di Bibione, the Dolphin of Bibione, otherwise known as the Pelican, otherwise known as Franco Pellizzotti. But it was a very somber mood outside the Bahrain Victoria's bus, somber mood among the staff, obviously, because disaster befell their leader, Michel Landa, today, didn't it?
Yeah, a somber day. There were the stage was marred by a few nasty crashes, and we'll get onto that and whether the running was particularly dangerous. We'll hear from our diarist James Knox on that very subject. Such a pity, 24 hours after the biggest win of his career, Joe Dombrowski found himself on the deck with Michel Landa. He's still in the race, but he was badly banged up. I saw him coming across the line, blood coming from his face and holding his arm. So not great at all. I said in our little vlog that we recorded earlier, the sport gives and the sport takes away. It picks you up and it dumps you down on the ground. And we spoke to Joe Dombrowski this morning in Modena.
He marched into the mix zone and the real thing were playing on the loudspeaker.
You've been singing that all day.
Yeah, girl, you've got the best of me. No. What is it, Richard?
No,
you're
not.
You've had the rest
you're
of
not
me. Come trapping
on, take the me like
the
that.
Around. Anyway.
Anyway, yeah. A real pity, and Pavel Sivakov's the other one. We'll get onto all that. We've got a lot to hear, a lot of audio in this.
We shouldn't neglect
to describe where we are.
Yes.
Is what you're going to say.
Yes, and I you should draw on your most florid language, Richard.
Well,
and
the Verdant hills are stretched out in front of us. I mean, the wheat swaying gently as we crest.
Very idyllic scene, isn't it? A very idyllic sunset.
Oh,
we're
idyllic. Yeah.
We're on top of a hill about 10 kilometers from Jesi in this area, this region of Le Marche, which is really characterized by rolling green hills and beautiful hilltop medieval towns. In a lot of cases,
we've come a little bit inland because you don't like the sea.
That is true. I'm not particularly fond of the sea. Anyway,
well, it's lovely here. It's getting a bit chilly now as the sun drops behind the hills ahead of us, but what a great spot, and what a lovely Italian hospitality is the best in the world, I think.
It's magnificent, isn't it? And you, I think, are enjoying some homemade beer. Is it homemade beer?
I am enjoying some
homemade
beer.
Certainly the proprietor of our lodgings this evening participated in the making of this beer, and I'm enjoying a lovely glass of Verdicchio di Jesi, a typical white wine from this area.
Well, let's get straight into it. Daniel, the tail of the tappa, 177 kilometres from Modena, beautiful Modena, absolutely stunning town, to Cattolica on the coast here. Pan flat stage, so definitely one for the sprinters. But there was a hint of crosswinds at the start. The Giro not known for crosswind stages, but there was a real sense.
Italy is not a windy country at all.
Well, no, but it was quite windy today. Yeah. We know that because we stopped off at one point and it was very windy there. Bernard Eisel was talking this morning, suggesting there might be crosswinds. I pointed out Deceuninck and Quickstep, who normally bring a team suited to that, do not have that sort of team here at all. Just Remy Cavagna, really, that would be it. And Eisel was suggesting Jumbo-Visma might try something, but it didn't really materialise. However, the threat of crosswinds did force up the pace in the bunch, and it meant the two early breakaways, Filippo Tagliani of Androni Giocattoli and Umberto Marengo, Bardiani.
Marengo, of course, who was a famous Napoleonic battle. Marengo, I think.
I don't know. Got me there. Anyway, they were caught as the peloton sped up in anticipation of crosswinds. It never really materialised. And that meant we had no breakaway. And it did make me think about Mauro Vegni, the Giro director, and his criticism of Androni for just going in breakaways. I thought, be careful what you wish for, Mauro, because a stage like today without a breakaway is really not much of a spectacle. There's nothing.
And it hasn't just been the traditional sort of TV breakaway, first thing in the morning, off they go, because there have been a couple of stages where there have been counterattacks. Well,
one guy stayed away, let's not forget. Yeah. Taco van der Hoorn stayed away the other day. So we've only had one bunch sprint until today. Two other riders did go clear. Inevitably, an Androni rider, Simon Pillow, we've seen a lot on the attack over the last couple of years, and Davide Gaburo of also Bardiani. They were much later, joined by Alexis Goujard of AG2R. And they weren't caught until about 3 kilometres to go, so they stayed out a long time. But the finale was really marred by those awful crashes. First, Sivakov went down with 15 kilometres to go. You know, he was up near the front with the rest of his team. He seemed to clip a tree by the side of the road and fell very heavily indeed. And he's off for an X-ray, we understand. He didn't look very happy as he came in, as you'd expect. And you have to feel for Pavel Sivakov. Remember, day one at the Tour de France last year, he had two nasty crashes. That's, two Grand Tours in a row for him where his, you know, hopefully he carries on here, but his race been heavily compromised by nasty crashes. And Sivakov picked himself up, carried on, but was clearly not capable of chasing the bunch, which at that point was in full flight, setting up for the sprint. Then with 4 kilometres to go, another crash. Mikel Landa this time went down and stayed down for a long time. Joe Dombrowski as well. And, well, it appeared that they had collided with a marshal in the middle of the road who'd been waving a flag, pointing out a sort of traffic island, and they collided with him. You were sent some footage of this, Daniel.
Yeah, I was sent some video by a friend of a friend who was at the roadside, not a cycling fan, but happened to be there. And there was a gentleman signalling the central reservation, as you say, but you know, these flags they use, they're only able to raise them just above head height. And if you're 80 positions back in the peloton, it's quite difficult to see sort of half an orange flag above everyone's head. And, you know, just the whole finale, well, maybe we'll talk about this later, but the whole finale for a seafront finish, which generally speaking are some of the most straightforward finishes, it was fiddly, wasn't it? It was fiddly for a few kilometres.
It was difficult. We drove in the last 10 kilometres and it was twisty and the road was quite uneven and bumpy in places. And just tonight, the UCI have announced their decision on Nasser Bouhanni and suspended him for 2 months for altering his line in a recent sprint finish with Jake Stewart where he took him into the barriers. And I just thought, this is becoming a trend. You know, Dylan Groenewegen was suspended for 9 months, now Bouhanni. That's fine, but the UCI has to have some responsibility for the safety of these finishes, especially in a Grand Tour. You know, this should be the very pinnacle of the sport. Well, we'll hear from James Knox on this a bit later on. The sprinters' teams just carried on as you'd expect. Caleb Ewan was up at the front pretty early, and then drifted back. Bora Hansgrohe really took it on and really strung out. Daniel Oss was on the front and really setting a fearsome pace. It was just a line behind him. And there were riders like Dylan Groenewegen who I think were caught out by that because he was pretty far back at that point and could never make up the distance.
Daniel Oss, who in the mix zone this morning was wearing a face mask with La Dolce Vita written on it. La Dolce Vita being probably the most famous film of Federico Fellini, who's the most famous Italian film director, who's from Rimini, and I believe the race went
nice
through
tribute.
Rimini.
What a cultured chap, and I think we'll learn a little bit more about his appreciation of Italy's culture.
Particularly from this region. Yeah.
The sprint then was as a result of Oss's injection of pace, it was actually a reasonably safe sprint, although Tim Merlier, the Ciclamino jersey wearer, was impeded a little bit. Caleb Ewan seemed to bounce off him a bit, but his chain jumped as well, so he couldn't really contest the sprint. And it was opened up by Elia Viviani, went hard on the right. Then Giacomo Nizzolo came past him, looked to be heading for his first stage within a Grand Tour after 10 second places. But weaving through the bodies, Caleb Ewan, an astonishing burst of speed in the last 70 or 80 metres, really impressive. And he was a very convincing winner, won by over a length in the end. So Caleb Ewan, who in the press conference afterwards made absolutely no bones about the fact that he will not finish this Giro. He's going to try and win stages in all three Grand Tours this year.
He's going to do the old kiss and fly, stage 12 kiss
and fly. Yeah, I was quite surprised about how open he was, but I'm not sure if he realised that that maybe wasn't the best thing to be saying about talking about when he was going to be leaving the race at this point. Anyway, Caleb Ewan first, Nizzolo second, the 11th second place of his career in Grand Tours, Viviani third, Sagan fourth, and Gaviria fifth. Pink jersey still DeMarchi, but Vervec moves up to second with Oliveira third. Joe Dombrowski still in the mountains jersey because there were no mountains today, but he finished in a bad way. Ciclamena now Giacomo Nizzolo, so some consolation for him there.
Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success. The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens.
Thank you very much to our new title sponsor, Super Sapiens. We've heard from the founder, Phil Sutherland, in previous episodes. Phil is a type 1 diabetic who knows all about how important real-time glucose monitoring is. But how can it help all athletes improve their fueling to help them train more effectively? Well, the Super Sapiens is a continuous glucose monitoring system that helps you make the right fueling choices. Over time, the user learns how best to manage their energy resources. It takes the guesswork out of when and what to eat. How does it work? Well, the Abbott Libre Sense glucose sport biosensor sticks to the back of the upper arm. A thin filament is inserted just under the skin, which accurately measures your glucose levels, and it then sends real-time glucose data to the Super Sapiens app. Each biosensor patch lasts 14 days. Teams using it already, Jumbo-Visma, Ineos Grenadiers, and Canyon SRAM. Track your glucose, master your fueling, and optimize your training and recovery is pretty much what Super Sapiens allows you to do. We're running a competition with a fantastic prize. We've got three months free supplies of the biosensor patches. That's three winners. We'll each win a 3 month supply of the patches. All you have to do is send in an audio clip or a video message explaining how you will use Super Sapiens to help you achieve whatever cycling ambition you have. It doesn't have to be Everesting or cycling around the world. It can be ambitious relative to your cycling
It could be
mincing around northern France.
Very slowly.
I'm not eligible, unfortunately.
Crawling Picardy. Around the lanes.
Whatever your circumstances, if you fancy 3 months free supply of Super Sapiens, so tell us why you'd like 3 months free supply of the biosensor patches. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com and have a look at how to enter there. If you want to find out more about Super Sapiens, go to supersapiens.com.
Briefly, Rich, before we move on the subject of blood sugar, and we mentioned how sweet Riccardo Ricco's ice cream was yesterday, the Cobra. Before I forget, I must add the postscript to yesterday's story of our trip to see the Cobra. He did call me, didn't he? And you were there.
Ignored his call. Well, we were
eating, and I take table etiquette quite seriously. And I thought, I'll call him later. And you know, we'll have our long-awaited catch-up. And I called him twice today, sent him a message, and he was less inclined.
He's ghosting you.
Less inclined to indulge us today, but
maybe keep trying.
We will.
It's nice that he called you back anyway. Well, Daniel, the talk of the stage, Caleb Ewan, obviously a fantastic victory. I mean, proved definitively he's the fastest sprinter in the race, but as we've said, the stage was really marred by those crashes. It's such a pity. I mean, I watched back the stage yesterday and the climb, and, you know, we sort of mentioned it in last night's episode, but I reflected again on how significant Landa was in drawing that group of GC guys clear. It was a great attack by him, which suggested he was in fantastic form.
He was, and our diarist Gino Maeda sent us a little message last night talking about the stage and, you know, how well everything had gone for Bahrain and how good Landa looked. this is not intended to be flippant, because I know it's a serious crash, and we do feel, you know, we all feel terrible for Mikel Landa. We wanted him to do very well here. But Rich, you know, the whole, we did make the joke yesterday about Pope Landa, didn't we? And you asked me today, is Católica, does that mean Catholic? Has that got something to do with Catholics?
As I said that, I thought this, it was kind of a bad omen.
Yeah, it was a terrible omen, wasn't it? It was a terrible omen.
So, I mean, Landa's not, had, you know, crashed out in this sort of way too often, but he's often just, as I said last night, he's chasing, or he's up against it, or something's happened that's, you know, the crosswind stage at the Tour a couple of years ago, through no fault of his own, he loses time. And here, everything seemed to be ready for him to at least, you know, show us what he can do in these climbs, and in quite an open race.
And there was a nice sort of symbolism about yesterday, and a sort of circularity about yesterday, in that Sestola, the stage to Sestola in 2016, was where he, well, it was really the sort of the incident or the episode, the day, the stage that characterised his effort to become a Grand Tour leader at Sky. He'd gone into the Giro there as the sole leader, and I think that was that his first Grand Tour at Sky? And it seemed like a new dawn for Landa when he joined Sky, and that he was going to be the star there. And what happened on the stage to Sestola in 2016, he got a stomach bug, didn't he? And he
shades of Jacques Anquetil, yeah, at the Tour de France. It was a barbecue the previous day or
and
something.
He pulled out, I think he barely made it out of the neutralized zone. And then fast forward to yesterday, we're going to Sestola again, and he's the most impressive general classification rider in the race.
And I'm not sure I sort of gave him enough credit last night for that. I mean, Bernal looked great as well. He looked the equal of Landa, but it was Landa that really started the fire, you know, and he's an exciting rider. He makes races more interesting, and it's such a loss to the race.
He has that slightly mystical air about him, in the way that, you know, today we were in
a papal air.
Yeah, but today we were in Pantani country, and Pantani, this sort of mysticism was kind of conferred upon Pantani. You know, even when he says things in interviews that were quite banal, they would take on a sort of mystical, almost shamanic kind of quality. And Landa has a little bit of that. I mean, witness this, you know, this term that's been coined of Landismo, as I said yesterday.
Well, Landissimo, no?
Landismo.
Sorry, I don't want to pronunciation police you here. But
it is almost a religion, a cult.
Yeah, free Mikel Landa. You know, he's been sort of almost a, like Pantani, almost a martyr, a kind of downtrodden character in a way. And he always appears very, the expression on his face doesn't really change, but he looks sad.
Yeah, ill-starred.
And I was looking for more melancholic.
Yeah,
is a more poetic.
And the Movistar documentary, the Movistar series on Netflix last year, reinforced that, didn't it?
It did. So I really, and you know, when you look at that, the course and that particular obstacle, it was a crash waiting to happen, and he wasn't the only one who came down. We'll hear from Joe Dombrowski a bit later on, speaking at the start this morning. I mean, let's hear from our diarist James Knox, who knows this area very well, spent a lot of time here as an under-23 rider.
That's stage 5 out the way, because wasn't a very nice final 25-30k there. Try and choose my words carefully, just a bit unnecessarily dangerous, to be honest. Narrow, tight, fast, obviously big stress in the peloton after a relatively straightforward day. There was a bit of wind, everyone got a bit nervous there, but nothing happened. But I think doesn't help now, everyone's got every GC team, every sprinter's team in the same boat. Everyone's got on the radio, DS, telling them what to do, be in front, stay together, be in front, move forward. And yeah, from where I was, trying to stay with the boys, it was pretty grim. Just a lot of stuff coming out of nowhere, to be honest. Flying into roundabouts, road furniture, left, right, narrow bits, curbs, pavements. Obviously a few crashes as well, which pretty sad to see. Joe Dombrowski, the winner yesterday, down. Could have been on for the pink jersey tomorrow. Lost a load of time. Pretty nasty crash. Landa out of the race. One of the most exciting riders in the race. Sivakov also. Yeah, and also I think a steward got hit, so I hope he's all right. A little bit frustrating from a rider's perspective, I guess. Difficult to know what to say, isn't it, on that one. It was really a race of two halves anyway. I rolled around for the first 60, 70k with sleeves rolled up, socks rolled down, thinking about the best way to get a tan. And then, yeah, had to quickly sort that out, and then scurry around and get myself into the right headspace to start battling around and scrapping and, yeah, doing what needed to be done, but I was right in the thick of it for those Sivakov and the other crash, and head sort of went at that moment and just lost the boys and floated around at the back. But happy that our lads are all safe and sound, of course. No time lost. I mean, it wasn't exactly much to talk about today, but it's an area I know well. Past Cesena, San Vignanzo, Rubicone, all the little towns and stuff that I know from a couple of seasons spent riding for Zappis in Cervia near Cesenatico. Yeah, well, I don't think we really did the area really any justice today. You can go into the hill, lots of little lovely little hills there, nice roads. Actually really miss training here. I mean, it's a bit sketchy. I mean, some of the roads are a bit iffy and there's holes and cracks and this and that. We used to crash every now and then, but good fun. Lovely people, lovely place. Stopped for a coffee and a crostata when Zappi wasn't keeping an eye on us. It was a bit of a difference to the Cesenatico stage of last year anyway, where we just did the full, all the climbs. Other than that, safe and sound. On to tomorrow. Tricky day. Climb to the finish, pretty hard. Going back into the middle of Italy, so the roads are never... Yeah, they're always pretty technical, up and down, left and right. So, big job for tomorrow. Make sure Remco in the front, ready to go, and see what happens.
That was James Knox, one of our audio diarists. And we've just had an installment from our other audio diarist, Gino Mader, of Team Bahrain Victorious. A teammate, of course, of Mikel Landa.
Yeah, Gino here after stage five, and obviously. Yeah, black shadow over today's day. I mean... We are actually all really, really sad. Once for Mikel himself, it's a shame to crash out of this Giro that started so well, actually, and where he already proved to be in a really good shape. For the team, it's difficult to know what exactly we can now suspect for next stages. We probably need a day or two to recalibrate and, yeah, get the new goals in place and start focusing on the second part, the after Mikel part. We do not have any news now on how he's doing. We all hope he's not too bad and that he's going to recover quickly. For me, basically, now the finish... It's always easy to say it's dangerous, and obviously it is dangerous because one guy does a mistake and then you lose your leader, which is the worst thing. But it's probably too difficult right now to say anything about. It surely wasn't an easy finish. It wasn't an easy finale, but we are all professionals. We are all sitting on the bike for a huge amount of time, and normally we are quite active and concentrated in a finale like this. So for the moment, I find it difficult to blame somebody. It wouldn't be fair. Heads up, resting, and we keep on attacking.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2021 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport. And if you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. Well done, Daniel. SISCP25. And if you'd like to enter our competition to win a bundle of Science and Sport goodies worth £80, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Super Sunday, again, each Sunday during the Giro, we're offering this bundle of Science and Sport goodies. If you can predict the winner.
Should we go from Super Sunday to Super Savio?
Gianni, I can see you're reluctant to do the formation, the model, or in English, I'm speaking Italian now. You haven't had much practice in English, I guess, over the last few months. But today's stage, 330 metres of dislivello. Not very much climbing today. What's the modulo?
The modulo is 4-3-1. Four climbers, so they await. It's not their race today. My English is always very bad, eh? Very bad.
Gianni,
so I hope that people can understand.
It gets better every single year.
No. Thank you. And after three, Venchiarutti, Taliani, Pellot, Ponomar. There are four, but we hope that these four, we must choose one for the breakaway. So is 4-3-1. One is to be in the breakaway. But I cannot know if there will be Ponomar, Venchiaruti, Taliani or Pellot, because it depends. They work together to put one of them in the breakaway.
And for these flat stages, Gianni, you don't really have a bomber, do you?
No. I think that is normally there will be a massive sprint. And in this massive sprint, we have one of two sprinters, Filippo Taliani or Nicola Venchiaruti.
Last thing, Gianni, in the pink jersey we have one of your old riders, Alessandro De Marchi. You sort of gave him his first opportunity, really, in a big team. Tell me about sort of discovering Alessandro De Marchi.
Yes, Alessandro De Marchi was a good amateur, and he was also a good pistard. Pistard is French, but so for this reason was Alessandro Bertolini, my old rider, who asked me, Gianni, there is a young rider, very good, and so if you can sign, and I sign. I was very happy yesterday, because he is a strong rider and a very, very good people. So I sent him a message immediately. I was very happy.
Well, it's fantastic to finally catch up with our old friend, our very good friend, Gianni Savio. It's the first time in this Giro that we've spoken to Gianni. And as usual, he was full of life and full of insight and came up with a novel formation for today, the 7-3-1, was it?
That would be 11 riders.
That would be borderline illicit. the 3-4 or the 4-3-1. And also, they're talking about Alessandro De Marchi, who's still in the pink jersey, was sort of launched as a professional by Gianni. De Marchi gave a very nice press conference again today. Yesterday's was excellent. And today he spoke about tomorrow's stage. It's a mountaintop finish. How is he going to keep the jersey? Can he keep the jersey? And he said he has no special sort of tactics in mind or even special mindset going into tomorrow's stage. It's just going to be a question of legs, and he really needs to perform over and above his sort of usual level in the mountains to keep that pink jersey, I think.
Just before we go on, Daniel, while I remember, I also should put a shout out for questions for our press conference next Tuesday, first rest day. We'll be doing it slightly differently this year. Send us your audio clips, please, as per usual, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Any question at all, any written questions that you email in, will be dealt with in video format by our new highly popular vlogs, an extended version of that. So you can send in your questions in audio form or written form, please. I want to also just give a shout out to Jack McKillop and his mate. I got a message from Jack McKillop. Rich Costello is a friend of the podcast, quite a recent listener, but a friend of the podcast. And he was hit by a car last week, I think, in Vancouver in Canada. Jack says that listening to the podcast will be one of the few things for him to enjoy over the coming weeks. So I hope you are enjoying it, Rich, and I hope you recover soon from your crash. That's sad to hear. And the theme of the day
was the theme of the day. Well, theme of this morning was really mopping up from yesterday's first general classification day, wasn't it? And you know, there were a few interesting, curious, intriguing performances to sort of pick apart, and we tried to do that a little bit with some of the parties, some of the riders and team managers concerned. Simon Yates, people expected a little bit better from him yesterday. On the other hand, most people were quite impressed by Alexander Vlasov of Astana. Their respective direct sportives, Matt White, good friend of the podcast, we hear from him a lot, don't we? And then Beppe Martinelli, the most successful Giro d'Italia director sportive of all time, I think. And here they are with a little bit of sort of post-match analysis from yesterday.
Ma noi, in una tappa come quella di ieri, credevo che ci fossero squadre
I thought yesterday teams would ride differently. I thought there were teams who would be really keen to keep the race together, to go for the win and the jersey. There were a lot of guys who did good enough time trials to still be in with a shout for the pink jersey. And, well, when 25 riders went away, everyone looked at each other. I put my guys on the front, but we couldn't bring it back on our own, because I don't have a strong enough team here to do that. I'm still trying to figure out what a lot of the strong teams are doing. You think they're going to make the race, but then they ride quite passively. I'm thinking of a team like De Koenig. They've come here with an unbelievably strong team, the strongest in the race, I think, and yet they don't even fight for the stage win or the pink jersey yesterday. Okay, I get it, maybe it's too early, but often too early becomes too late.
So Matt, yesterday Simon lost a bit of time. People basing their sort of predictions on what he did at the Tour of the Alps, didn't expect that. What was the sort of debrief?
He lost a little bit of time, 11 seconds. There was just a moment there where he couldn't react at that instant, and there was a gap, and he couldn't bridge that gap, and then got caught by that second group, and they lost a little bit of time, but that's 10 seconds. That's 10 seconds. The cold, it was a little bit harder day than it may have looked. And some guys lost a lot of time, some guys gained lost a little bit, but neither here nor there.
Are you a believer in the fact that the first big climb, it wasn't a massive climb, but of a Grand Tour, can be a little bit sort of deceptive at times, or some people can really suffer more than they ordinarily would?
Sometimes people do react. I don't think yesterday was a big mountain stage per se. It was just more like a very tough medium mountain stage, but I think with the conditions, what really changed yesterday. Very technical, and I think they had 4.5 hours of rain. They started in the rain, nearly finished in the rain, and it wasn't freezing cold, but it wasn't when you're wet for 5 hours and 10 degrees, it has an effect on sort of people. And I think tomorrow we've got the first proper sustained climb on stage 6. That's that'll be more of an indication of where the climbers are, real climbers are at, because when you look at even yesterday, there was some gaps. Some like Almeida and a couple of other guys lost. Well, GC's over for those guys, but again, 5 seconds here, 10 seconds here. All those favourites were in that bracket there between, was it 1:48 and 2:11. So, nothing much to see out of yesterday's little final.
So, Rich, what did you make of that? Martinelli sort of almost not criticising De Koenig, but curious that they didn't, they weren't more aggressive yesterday, and they didn't really seem to take the race on, and he was certainly mystified by that. But I suppose, we know that Almeida wasn't on a great day, don't we? And we don't really know how Evenepoel felt or how he's going. It's so early in this, well, reboot, as you called it, in your Kilometre Zero today.
Which came out today. Good plug, Daniel. I think De Koenig and Quickstep were quite aggressive at one point in the race before it became obvious that Almeida wasn't having a good day. As you say, so much is unknown about Evenepoel. I think everybody, including Matt White, who we spoke to a couple of days ago, was expecting quite a big offensive from De Koenig Quickstep yesterday, because they'd gone for these intermediate sprints and because Almeida and Evenepoel had both been up there in the time trial. There was a real chance for them to take the pink jersey. But on the day, Almeida obviously had a terrible day and is out of it. And I heard a few people say Evenepoel, it wasn't his sort of climb. It was too explosive for him. And it was interesting speaking to Joe Dombrowski, we hear from in a moment, sort of downplaying the severity of the stage. He made the point, and a lot of people made the point, it was the weather that really turned it from a routine medium mountain stage into something quite hashtag epic, or very, very much more difficult or challenging. And I wonder if it may be a bit of an aberration. We didn't see Simon Yates at his best. We didn't see Evenepoel at his best, I don't think. And who knows whether that's a sign of where they are or whether they just had bad days because they were cold on the day. Who knows?
You talked earlier, you alluded to this issue that we're hearing quite a lot about, and the slight concern that some teams have about overloading riders with information. Had a really interesting chat with Matt White as well, just after what he said about Yates yesterday, just about the process that he goes through reckoning the stages.
Reckoning.
I get confused with this word.
Well,
we used to say recce
in the old days.
Reckoning the course, which Matt goes off on a big trip every spring. And, I've always got the sense that he really enjoys those trips.
And so, he's going off to re-recce the gravel stage on the rest day, we believe.
A double recce.
A third time, I think.
And yeah, we spoke a lot, and we will play this probably tomorrow or in the coming days, just about that process of preparing, particularly in the pandemic, when it hasn't been possible for a lot of riders to go. Teams are increasingly relying on apps and things like VeloViewer. VeloViewer, of course, our partner on the Cycling Podcast. Any information you need about stages, log on to VeloViewer. They're still only £10 for their annual subscription. Best value in cycling. Anyway,
not the best value in cycling, Daniel. That's a friend of the podcast subscription.
Anyway, yes, we will hear more from Matt about that process in the next few days. But it was very well. It was intriguing. I should have also said that today Martinelli was going back to, well, Pantani country, wasn't he? So he also told me it was going to be a special day for him. Obviously, it wasn't a climbing stage, so the memories were a little less sort of vivid than they would be on a mountain stage or a climbing stage. But still, you know, it's always a poignant day when the Giro goes back to Cesenatico in that region for Martinelli.
We also wanted to catch up this morning with Joe Dombrowski, the winner yesterday, because we weren't able to do so after he took his stage win. It was his 30th birthday today as well, so we start by wishing him a happy birthday.
Happy birthday. I've finally left my 20s behind.
Yeah, yeah, coming of age performance.
Yes, I'm starting to feel old though.
But congratulations, Joe. I mean, in the past you've maybe made your efforts at the wrong time. Yesterday you played it perfectly, but DeMarchi said afterwards that he was worried that he'd missed out, you know, when the two riders were up the road. Did you think the same, or were you confident it would come back?
The stage wasn't so demanding yesterday in terms of like the parkour itself. And, you know, it's not that it was a mountain stage where it doesn't really make a difference if you're in the wheel or not. And I felt that to be up there alone with a group rotating behind you are going to spend a lot of energy. And the last climb, it was only 4K, but it was quite steep. And if you've spent a lot in the 40K before, even with 40 seconds or a minute, I think it's possible to get caught. And also I felt I could play off DeMarchi a bit because he had some seconds on me in the GC. And obviously he was thinking, you know, he could take the pink jersey. So you have to, you know, try and use that to your advantage.
And there was a moment on the climb where you really kind of pressed home your advantage, because he was coming back at you, Ben. I guess you didn't want to come to the finish with him, did you?
No, for sure. I think the only way I can win a bike race is to win alone. So better I don't bring him with me.
I mean, you've been practicing that celebration?
No, it was just spontaneous.
You're pretty close to the pink jersey. Do you think, you know, Daniel was suggesting there might be a possibility. Is that in your thoughts?
I mean, it could be. You know, tomorrow it's, I don't think I know the climb. It's not hard, but it's enough to make a selection. And if DeMarchi is dropped and I have good legs and can stay with the guys in the front, then it's possible. It would be something.
Rich, where are we?
We're standing by a motorway, Daniel.
A very busy motorway, somewhere between Bologna and Imola. More specifically, Rich, where are we? What are we standing next to?
We're standing in the shadow, Daniel, of a giant marble.
How giant is this marble?
I would say about 5 meters across.
Diameter? Is that the term you're looking
that
for?
It's got Marco Pantani in it.
Well, we talked about this, didn't we, the other day? This is the Pantani monument, the marble, the giant marble, the maxi marble, outside the old, now deserted, Mercatone Uno headquarters. Mercatone Uno, of course, being the sponsors of Pantani's team in his heyday. Big supermarket chain, now gone bust, went bust last year, leaving the future and present of the marble uncertain. And in fact, today, Rich, I mean, what we're surrounded by, there are three guys cutting some pretty poorly, previously, before today, I think, poorly tended grass in front of the Mercatone Uno office block. And you can hear the motorway in the background. It's a very odd scene, isn't it?
Well, it's odd for us to have stopped here, obviously. I mean, from the motorway, we drove past the marble, and it's quite a striking objet d'art. I mean, it's quite nice. I like it. It could do with a clean, if these gentlemen who are cutting the grass could maybe give it a clean as well, because it gets pretty grimy. But as these things go, it's nice. It's nice and simple. There's a photograph of Pantani, I think the 98 Giro, in the pink jersey. with just his name above that, and it's pretty classy. I like it.
Well, we talked about these marbles, didn't we, that apparently this is a big thing in Italy, big thing in particularly this region and the coastal resorts where we'll be later. Kids used to play marbles a lot, maybe still do, on the beach. It was the done thing, apparently. And a lot of these marbles had the images of cyclists in them in Merckx's day, in Gimondi's day. And that was what inspired the artist responsible for the objet d'art to go for, well, a marble homage. But, Rich, the big question now, I've been gathering from the local press, is who it belongs to, or not so much who it belongs to, but who it will belong to in the future. Because, as I said, the business Mercatone Uno has gone bust. It's gone bust twice in the last few years, but the most recent sort of liquidation seems to have been definitive. But the office block behind us is still owned, I think, by the Cenni family, the original founders of Mercatone Uno, and they still own the marble, and they want to keep the marble, and they want to keep it where it is. But there are various people that have got designs on the marble. The town of Cesenatico, just up the coast, where we'll be later, they want to take it. It would be quite tricky, wouldn't it?
I mean, anyone who's played marbles, as we all have, knows that to move a marble, you need a bigger marble and throw it and dislodge it. And, I mean, I can imagine what would that bigger marble...
It would need a kind of meteorite.
We need to have Lance Armstrong's image in it, I think, to really dislodge it properly. But presumably somebody else would take over this office block, which is quite nice. Do they want Marco Pantani in the ground?
Well, that's a good question. But as I said, the town of Cesenatico, that's one...
Should we launch a crowdfunder appeal for this to become the new headquarters for
the Cycling Podcast instead of not
Watford? Podcast Towers.
Yes. Yeah, the Cenni family want it here, as I said, despite the fact that Cesenatico there, I think they would probably take it to, maybe put it by one of the other Pantani monuments there are in Cesenatico. Maybe the Pantani Museum, very good Pantani Museum in Cesenatico. But the people of Imola also apparently are they're quite fond of this marble because it's been here for 15 years. And it's kind of, it's a very visible landmark from the motorway. The people of Imola, they see it, they know they're close to their home. And it's the fourth most popular tourist attraction in Imola. I mean, how you could, as a tourist, when this place was still up and running, get in and, do what we're doing now, I'm not quite sure. But
having mentioned it on the podcast a couple of nights ago, Daniel, we had to fight our way through the crowds to get here, didn't we? To this barren scrubland.
But Imola is not a small place. It's got other things going for it, of course. And tragically, this was the site of Ayrton Senna's death. And in fact, I'm talking about the motor racing circuit where he died in the San Marino Grand Prix. And there's a memorial to Senna in Imola, which is above the Pantani marble in that list of most visited attractions in Imola. Rich, final thing on the marbles. I said it's probably a bigger thing than we realised. That was confirmed to me this morning because Daniel Oss was in the mix zone and our friends from Bidon, the Italian podcast, were asking him, what in his mind is synonymous with this coastline and Cattolica, and he said playing marbles on the beach.
Now, can we get some ice cream? Or was that just yesterday?
Well, that was a Pantani marble. Quite a...
Impressed? Were you impressed?
Quite a tourist attraction. I thought it was nice. Nice, sorry. Sorry, I usually save that word for wine. It was pretty classy, though. And, the view of it from the... When you see it up close, you can sort of, it's funny that the Mercatone Uno headquarters that's based there are so keen on it because the view of it from behind is not quite as appealing as from the front because it's just an orange base sort of behind it. You really can't appreciate it unless you're driving past it from the motorway.
It's an interesting area of Italy, not really my favourite part of Italy, I must say. Once you get past Imola and you get towards those coastal resorts, Riccione, Cesenatico, Cesena, and I always obviously think of... Well, I don't like the sea. It's quite flat. It becomes quite flat. It's synonymous with Pantani. It's a region as well with a very rich history of, MotoGP. And there's an interesting intersection in sort of Italian sporting history when Pantani's fall began at a time of huge prosperity and success for Italian MotoGP. And in fact, Rich, Valentino Rossi, he wasn't born in Cattolica, but he's an honorary citizen because he grew up 6 kilometers down the road. And also from Cattolica, was Marco Simoncelli, who died tragically in a crash in Sepang, I think in Malaysia, in 2011. So, you know, it has that rich sporting heritage. There are a lot of motor racing circuits around there. Mugello, the Tuscan circuit, is not very far away. The Italians know it well for the coastal resorts. It's a typical place to sort of go when you're a teenager or in your early 20s, and you know, you hit the clubs. And there's a good film on Netflix called Sotto il Sole di Riccione, Under the Sun of Riccione, and it's kind of a coming of age tale about precisely that, kids going there or teenagers going there. It's not the most highbrow film. Also, Rich, relating to this region, on Netflix, I would recommend a documentary called Sampa. It's a documentary about a rehab clinic set up by a gentleman called Vincenzo Muccioli in the late 1970s, and it became very, very controversial. Just above Rimini, the clinic is still there, I think, but very much recommend.
You've been recommending that to me, and I've been wanting to watch it, but unfortunately, the last couple of nights, the internet has been not quite equal to the Italian hospitality, shall we say, in the places that we've been staying. Hopefully tonight's better. Just seeing on the internet here, a picture posted by Lara Messiger, who, with Rob Hatch, hosts El Cycling Podcast, our sister podcast in Spanish. She posted a picture of Landa lying on the road with a bike nowhere in sight, and it just kind of brings home the sadness of what happened to him today and the pain that he was in when he crashed. So, yeah, we're kind of it's kind of darkened the mood a bit tonight, hasn't it, Wam, to Landa? But you're about to lift it again, Daniel.
Well, I am. You know, I was just talking about the region. My one regret from today, Rich, is that we didn't get ourselves a piadina, one of the sort of Romagnolo, the pancakes, savoury pancakes filled often with cheese and ham. And of course, Pantani's family used to run, well, and still do, in fact. His sister Lionel and I went there a couple of years ago to his sister's piadineria in Cesena, dico. But, Rich, the region we started in today, synonymous with, well, balsamic vinegar. It's a fantastic area for food.
Mary Queen of Scots.
Yes, well, we're just on the edge
was
of
born
the
there.
We're just on the edge of the Parmigiano Reggiano region. But it's also well known for music and a very famous singer,
Pavarotti. Yes,
Pavarotti was
born
not
there.
The one I was thinking of,
but he was born there too.
Ask most the average Italian, ask them about music and Modena, and they'll give you one name, and that's Vasco Rossi. Rich, what do you know about Vasco
Well,
Rossi?
I know you're playing him in the car today. Not really my... Too upbeat for me.
Very much. But it's an extraordinary phenomenon. And as soon as I saw Modena on the route this year, I thought, I have to try to communicate to an English-speaking audience who Vasco Rossi is and why he carries
it's
such
like the
influence.
Italian Johnny Halliday.
Well,
is he?
He's Johnny Halliday plus. He's Johnny Halliday
on steroids.
Well, possibly, allegedly. It occurred to me that you can't really explain Italy and the Italians to an English-speaking audience without, you know, using Vasco Rossi as a little bit of a prism. So I thought, who could tell me about Vasco Rossi? Who could do that job of explaining Vasco Rossi to the English-speaking, the Anglophone audience? Daniel Oss rides for Bora Hansgrohe, has a very keen interest, particularly in rock music. And there's another rider, Italian rider, at Bora Hansgrohe, who happens to be from a place called Finale, which is close to Modena. So he also ideally plays to tell us about Vasco Rossi. So I got them together yesterday in the mix zone, and here they are.
And Modena is famous in Italy for many things, but one thing in particular, Vasco Rossi. You're passionate about music. Giovanni, you're from Modena. Explain to someone who's not from Italy why Vasco Rossi is such a phenomenon.
But actually it was a phenomenon because I know stories about Vasco Rossi. He started like a DJ. He was really introducing the music as a first guy. But from that point, around Modena, even Ligabue grow as an artist and with the new music for Italy. Because Italy before was only kind of classic stuff, and then they arrive with electric guitar, bass guitar, and they introduce also the concept of concert and they grow a lot. I mean, was really a nice period for music, with Italian music. Okay, it's not like Led Zeppelin and all the stuff, we are speaking about Italian music, but it was a phenomenon in this area, special
moment.
Giovanni, one thing with Vasco that surprises me is the fans are very young. You're only 21, but people of that age still like Vasco Rossi.
Yeah, Vasco Rossi, as you said, and also Daniel said, is a legend in my home. And I think he's the best rock star in Italy. And I live also quite close to his house. He's in Modena, and close to Modena. And I heard also many stories. I am a bit young, but I heard stories from my family about Vasco as they were young. So it was, nice.
You came here for the cycling, listeners, and stayed around for the music.
Well,
hopefully
you can stay around for another couple of minutes because now we have got an Englishman trying to explain the phenomenon of Vasco Rossi to our listeners. John Foote. John Foote is one of our sort of points of reference, isn't he, for all matters Italian culture.
Man.
Yeah, for modern Italian history. And as a scholar of modern Italian history, he also needs to know a little bit about Vasco Rossi. So I also asked John about him before the Giro.
So, aging rock star, leather trousers, balding long hair, great songwriter in his youth, quite rebellious, went on and on and on, making more and more boring music, in my opinion, but just stayed successful. As you say, the audience got younger and younger, which is very bizarre. And, you know, I think a fun guy. I think really very funny to have on TV or interview. Has obviously had an enjoyable life. And he still can just about stand up and sing Una Vita Spericolata, whatever it is, which is his big hit about you know, being really having a really dangerous life and being really on the edge and driving his motorbike really fast. So that kind of, I mean, it is that kind of what we came back to before about the, you know, the love of old people. And I think there's some actually quite nice aspects of that. These old rock stars being dragged out on TV, but also slightly bizarre. But everyone loves Vasco. I mean, no one hates Vasco. He's really a national treasure. You know, it's like small level rebellion. It's not very political. Everyone can sing along to his songs. They can put their lighters up and you know, wear the squeeze into the leather trousers again for one last time and go along. And I think it's fun. And yeah, Ligabue, you know, he's a bit more sophisticated, but I think there's a very similar small town central Italy thing going on. There's lots of people like that. You could even put Pantani into that kind of mix of that central Italy thing, those big flat roads that people drive fast on, you know, driving to the sea to go to the beach every day. And I think that all stuff is very powerful.
So there you go, Rich.
Well,
enlightened?
Yeah.
Can you identify with that sort of provincial Italian idyll of, you know, a sort of reckless youth, you know, on your Vespa sort of powering, speeding through these beautiful Renaissance towns
your
Vespa?
I mean, I think it's refreshing that where the English language seems to be, you know, taking over culturally through the whole world, it is nice that local languages can be reflected in some of the cultural landscape, because you know, it would be a shame if we were all listening to the same music and watching the same films.
And I would encourage people, I mean, we've tried to convey just how important Vasco Rossi is, but go on YouTube and look at particularly his
I can't guarantee you'll like him,
but look up his Modena Park concert in 2017, as I wrote on Twitter today or on the podcast account, the biggest ticketed concert music gig of all time anywhere in the world. 225,000 people. There was one chap who queued for a month. He showed up a month before the doors were open.
Extraordinary. Well, I hope he felt it was worth it.
Rich, what are we going to eat tonight? Last night was excellent, wasn't it? We had
we
have lovely, we were in Lambrusco country, and we had a nice deep Lambrusco. We enjoyed the fact that it was only 11.5% alcohol, and we had a nice sort of Parmigiano, a Parmesan flan, and we had some pork, and we had cappelletti, filled pasta, which is typical of that region as well.
Lots of dishes, but all very, very small, which was nice, but it still added up to quite a lot, and I probably try and eat a bit less tonight. Let's wrap it up there. We'll be back tomorrow. Another important stage tomorrow. Big stage.
Mountaintop finish.
So we'll find out more. Yeah. Until then, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.